Nick, can we ask you to present from the, will you come up, please?
Thank you.
He's on the way.
No PowerPoints for me. Members of the board, President Easter, chancellors, and vice presidents, I'm pleased to report to you a very successful year for the University Senate's conference. In my written report, I've summarized our major accomplishments, including the creation of a very productive subcommittee structure, support for a number of important statutory changes, including the reversal of the chancellor vice president title, and a thorough review of how to bring our practices into alignment with the Open Meetings Act. I'm proud of the committee and the state of our relations with the president and with all of you. Shared governance is strong here at the University of Illinois. Former University of Michigan President Jim Duderstadt said that Illinois has the strongest system of shared governance in the country. A series of USC chairs has worked hard to build and maintain that system, and we're now working with a group of campus and university administrators who understand that a strong shared governance system produces decisions that are better and better understood and supported by faculty when they grow out of direct consultation, transparency, and a shared commitment to the well-being of the institution. To give you just one example, the National AAUP recently called for closer interactions between faculty and governing boards, concluding that, quote, communication between faculties and governing boards has worsened on many campuses in recent years. By way of contrast, here at Illinois, we have this regular opportunity to address the board with our perspectives and concerns. We have meetings with the chairman and other board members with the full USC, and opportunities for more informal and personal interactions as well. And we have growing ties between our four subcommittees and the four corresponding board subcommittees. Eventually, we hope you'll invite the chairs of the respective USC committees to be part of your committee meet discussions. That's up to you, of course. But what we've built here would be the envy of many other university faculties. Yes, we can do more and better, but I'm here today to celebrate with you what we have already accomplished. But I'm also here to share with you a concern that's troubled many of us over the course of the past year. I believe that we're now facing the greatest threat to shared governance that we have seen during my time in the Senate and Senate leadership. The following positions of my own, I'm not speaking for the full conference. I'm not going to take a position here today on the merits of faculty unionization itself. Faculty have the right to unionize, and state law gives duly established unions the power to negotiate over salary and working conditions. But I want to make the argument that a faculty union is not a governing body, and that unions have no place, per se, in the system of shared governance. Let me begin with the distinction between what I'll call constitutional and contractual systems of faculty-administrative relations. On the constitutional model, governance begins with founding documents that define the basic governing principles of the institution. They literally constitute the institution. That is, they describe the kind of institution it is. Just as with the national constitution, they lay out the values that serve as a foundation for all other policies and practices. And as foundational governing documents, they must be consensually supported by all members of the community, administrators, faculty, staff, and students. Those who ignore or violate those values, policies, and practices earn the disapproval of the community as a whole, and they cannot maintain legitimacy. Our governing documents are the statutes and the general rules. As with the national constitution, they can be modified, but not easily. It shouldn't be easy to change or to redefine our foundational principles. On the contractual model, the relation of faculty and administration is defined by a negotiated contract. It is binding on them only insofar as it is agreed to by the parties concerned. It has no necessary basis in enduring principle or value, and it remains in effect only for the duration of the contract, after which any part of it can be subject to renegotiation. This collective bargaining model might be in some people's minds an effective way to negotiate salaries, but it is a very poor basis for shared governance. Some union advocates say that collective bargaining can strengthen shared governance by making governance processes a part of a binding contract. And there are other universities where administrators have unfortunately shown that they will respect governance rules and processes only when they're required to do so. But this is not the case at Illinois, and several crucial elements of shared governance as we practice it here would be jeopardized if we were to follow that model. First, the nature of the contractual model is to begin with a presumption of conflicting interests that need to be negotiated through concessions on both sides. In its most severe manifestations, as we've seen on some of our own campuses, this model can become deeply adversarial, including open hostility, suspicion, mistrust, and accusations of bad faith. There is an unmistakable feel to these dynamics, that the administration is insensitive to faculty concerns and will only listen to them when they're forced to do so. By contrast, shared governance, when it is working as it should, begins with a presumption of shared commitment to the foundational governing documents and shared commitment to the best interests of the institution. This certainly doesn't mean we always agree about where those best interests lie or how to serve them, but even where there are disagreements, they are respectful and collegial. Under shared governance, administrators assume that the feedback and advice of faculty will help them make better decisions. They respect the faculty's fundamental rights and control over academic matters and involve them in a broad range of other decisions as well, even when they may not be strictly required to. Faculty, for their part, respect that administrators have an accountable responsibility for making certain decisions and sometimes have information and considerations that cannot be widely shared. They assume that senior administrators are faculty, share the value of faculty, and understand the concerns of faculty. The governance roles of administration and faculty are viewed as complementary, each having legitimate spheres of authority that need to respect one another. Shared governance is based on this reciprocal sense of co-responsibility. I do not see what's gained when administrators are forced to follow certain governance processes only because a negotiated contract requires them to do so. Under such an arrangement, they will do the absolute minimum they're required to do, share only the information they need to share, and accord faculty input only the token consideration they must. There may be other universities where that would be an improvement, but it is a very thin, ineffectual model of shared governance. In this distinction of constitutional and contractual models, I believe, we're presented with two fundamentally different and incompatible paradigms of the university, of faculty-administrative relations, and of how our governing conversations and processes should proceed. Second, as the Senate Conference affirmed in its resolution OT 295 last February, the status of our foundational governing documents is compromised if one campus or part of one campus can unilaterally modify or exempt itself from those documents. At one level, this raises the questions of how these documents can define us as an institution when they're no longer held in common. At another level, this jeopardizes the practical operations of the Senate's conference when it can no longer assume a commonly shared set of principles and policies which the conference, along with the board and others, is tasked with overseeing and protecting. But most seriously, for a single campus to take on itself the role of modifying these governing documents is a direct assault on the authority of the three senates and the Senate's conference itself, which according to the statutes, all must be involved in any such revisions. If union members or anyone else want to propose changes to the governing documents, there's an established process for doing so. Violating that process undermines the institutions of shared governance. It doesn't strengthen them. Third, I don't see how the Senate's conference can continue to function effectively if some of its members regard themselves as representatives of a union and serving on it. Depending on the nature of their union contracts, they may be enjoined from participating in certain discussions about salary and budget that the conference regularly engages in. They may face conflicting loyalties when they learn things in conference discussions that they want to carry back to their union colleagues in order to advance certain collective bargaining strategies. Or, most likely, the president, the vice presidents, and the board members meeting with the conference will simply not broach certain matters any longer if they cannot reasonably expect that they will be treated with some degree of confidentiality. And so the conference's deliberations and ability to provide meaningful advice will be severely compromised and shared governance weakened. The fact is that unions are not a category of representation in our governance system. Senators are elected by and represent their academic units and departments. Indeed, on many issues, senators and governance leaders should not be acting as direct representatives at all, but as advocates for the best interests of the institution as a whole. I don't know if it's true at Chicago, but at Urbana, our Senate members, many of them routinely identify themselves as members of CFA, the proto-union at Urbana. Fourth, the contractual model under Illinois labor law weakens shared governance in another important way. When disputes arise either through an unfair labor practice charge or a grievance under the contract, external parties would decide the merits and outcomes of those disputes. Unfair labor practice charges would be adjudicated by administrative law judges and the state labor board. Grievance processes mandated under the contract would be subject to binding arbitration by outside arbitrators. And so, crucial decisions affecting the university would be controlled by people who are not part of the university, or not part of the faculty or the administration. This could include interpreting and adjudicating sections of the statutes and general rules that have been absorbed into the collective bargaining contract. Finally, and to return to the central point, shared governance is at heart a matter of relationships. Relationships based on mutual respect, trust, and a presumption of shared commitment to the well-being of the institution. These relationships are slow to build and easy to damage, and once damaged, very difficult to reestablish. The most basic problem with the contractual model is the typical presumption that every contract is a fight with the bosses to force them to recognize and address the interests of the faculty. In that fight, all sorts of strategies are fair game, including protests, demonstrations, and slanders in the media. Accusations of bad faith, greed, and dishonesty are all familiar elements of such dynamics. It should be obvious that those kinds of dynamics are fundamentally incompatible with the spirit of shared governance, and I, for one, would not want to work at a university where they were the regular occurrences of everyday life. And I will say now what I would have said earlier this morning, if I've been successful at all in shared governance, it's because I've had great partners in shared governance at the campus level, at the university level, and here on the board, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Nick, I'd say that, you know, many of your thoughts resonate with me. I think there's an overarching issue, which is shared governance can be a competitive advantage, that great faculty wants to work in an institution with great shared governance, and anything that threatens that threatens the institution. And in my mind, that needs to be a driving organizational concept behind all of the decisions that we take as a board. I would also say, though, that I think the lifestyle of contingent faculty is awful, and that we collectively should advocate for a more respectful and human treatment of contingent faculty by society in general, and you know the Illinois schools specifically.
I agree with that point, and I'm not, in general, an anti-union person. I think there are a lot of university employees who ought to be unionized and need to be unionized to protect their rights. I don't deny that. It's just not the right model for tenured faculty.
Right, and I think it's a threat to the greatness of the University of Illinois.
Right.
And but those two facts can coexist.
I agree. Thank you.
But thank you very much for your thoughtfulness and the great partnership that you've taught all of us.
Thank
I appreciate you. That. I think we have one public comment speaker. And we're going to welcome Avanov Reddy at this time. So this is part of our part of our organizational philosophy to have a public comment period. It's, I believe, 5 minutes. And that number is pretty hard. And gets timed and then there's a buzzer. Traditionally, we don't respond to the public comments, but we appreciate the fact that you've been thoughtful enough to come here. Thank you.
And we thank you for the opportunity to speak here. My name is Abhinav Reddy, and I'm the president of the undergraduate student government here, and I'd just like to introduce my colleague, Aruj, who will be speaking to you today.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Aruj Shuib, and I'm currently a senior studying political science at UIC. I stand before you today to discuss Illinois Resolution 402, a resolution initiated by and in part drafted by our student government. The resolution asks the Board of Trustees of 9 public universities in the state to create a program that provides housing scholarships to homeless students. Currently, there is an estimated of 26,000 homeless youth in Illinois. This is coupled with the fact that homeless youth have a higher crime rate than those with stable housing. In 2005, a statewide study of homeless youth found that 22% had been kept into juvenile detention. The goal of this resolution is to alleviate that number by encouraging homeless youth to attend a post-secondary education. After high school, many students are conflicted with the decision of choosing between education or an immediate source of income. Since many of these students are born into poverty, finding a source of income to support themselves is a priority in order to maintain stable housing. This resolution was designed to create a program that would provide these students aid in paying for non-on-campus housing, which would allow for these students to attend a university and at the same time keep them off the streets. Also, housing would be an incentive to pursue a post-secondary education and therefore encourage homeless students to continue to work hard instead of immersing themselves into crime. So the question comes up, how did this all begin? As many of you know, this year, Governor Pat Quinn cut funding for Chicago Public Schools. As we were advocating in Springfield with the organization Chicago Coalition for the Homeless to prevent the cut from happening, we were given the opportunity to work with some individuals who attended CPS schools who were documented as homeless. When conversing with them, we discovered that their post-high school plans did not include a post-secondary education, and that this was mainly due to the fact that they did not have stable housing. This bill was originally inspired by those potential youth who wanted to attend a university but could not. It was reported that the most unmet services provided to homeless youth are finding a stable place to stay, finding a job, and returning or attending school. 56% are living in shelters and transitional housing, while 44% are unsheltered. This program would affect homeless youth who are faced with these common difficulties by providing them with stable housing in a positive environment where they can learn and grow. Investing in our youth's education is a huge factor in improving our economy. The cost to keep a youth in juvenile justice system every year is $53,665. The average cost of attending a four-year public university is $20,100. This is a fraction of the cost. Investing in homeless youth not only saves money, but investing in a child is beneficial to the economy. It was stated by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development that education leads to employment. The better education leads to the long lasting of employment. The long lasting of employment leads to a more stable economy. Enforcing this resolution would not only result in thousands of dollars being saved, but it would further invest in a more stable economy. So that begs the question, how does one define a homeless child? The common misconception of a homeless youth is the assumption that they all live on the streets. According to Public Health Service Act, a homeless individual is defined as an individual who lacks housing without regard to whether the individual is a member of the family, including an individual whose primary residence during the night is supervised, public or private facility that provides temporary living accommodations, and an individual who is a resident of transitional housing. Therefore, in order to be eligible, applicants must hold a homeless status certification that comes from Secretary of State Driver Service Department. The scheme proposed by this bill will utilize existing public administration services at no additional cost to target individuals who are in most need of housing. The homeless youth are the most vulnerable segments of our society, the most need of our attention. What distinguishes this group from others is that with minimal assistance, students who are in need of housing may actually get the opportunity to remove themselves from the cycle of poverty and crime that they are presently immersed in. This resolution provides a key solution to the reduction of large crime rates amongst homeless youth. It provides stability, opportunity, and education. Supporting this resolution can have a huge impact on the progression of our state. Thank you. That concludes my speech.
Thank you.
Good time.
Thank you both. Well done. So there's an announcement, or there's an indication of future board meetings for everybody in the book, and I think you all are probably aware of that. Is there any new business? Any old business? Okay, then we can entertain a motion to call the meeting to amend.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.